tweet. I know both Darcy and Karen are going to have some amazing things to say, so I love to see the tweets post session and retweet. A few other things. We're also going to shorten our Q&A to about 30 minutes so that we have time to get to as many of your questions as possible. So if you do have a question, start thinking about it, write it down, because I want to make sure we get through as many as we can today. And so instead of Karen and Darcy having to do what I find very excruciating, which is listen to your list of accomplishments when you're just thinking about how to get through today, I thought it would be great if they could introduce themselves and really talk about how marketing, branding, strategy has been a key component to their careers thus far. And then we're going to get into some questions where we talk about the marketing landscape, about social media, and then get to some of your questions. So with that, I'd like to introduce Darcy.
Thanks. Darcy Rudney, and I'm the Chief Communications Officer for Comcast Corporation. I handle very broad areas of communications in terms of external communication and working with the press, internal communications, working with we have 129,000 employees across the country, so you can imagine getting everybody, understanding your strategy and products and services is also very important. I handle M&A communications, federal affairs, messaging and communication on a variety of public policy issues, and corporate marketing and branding. I first started working in the area of branding actually more than 20 years ago when I went to work for the Pew Charitable Trust here in Philadelphia. And if any, those of you who are from Philadelphia may recall that the Pew Charitable Trust was a very, very, very quiet organization that made about $200 million in grants a year. And it was one of the best, it was one of Philadelphia's best kept secrets. And it's a wonderful organization. And I was first brought there to handle their external communications, but also to help them create a brand for themselves. And that was my first, that was really my first real working in the area of marketing communications, and it was a real privilege. And it was very interesting to be able to take an organization that was either not anybody was aware of it or was misunderstood. And so that was my first entry into branding, and it's just gone from there for a variety of different companies and topics.
Awesome. And Karen?
Yes, good morning. I'm Karen Reuter, and I'm principal and partner with Cass Collective in Boston. I'm a creative director and a brand strategist. Some of my friends call me a brand psychologist, really helping private equity, venture capital, and leading companies really leverage design as a strategy and innovation. I got my degree from Purdue University in industrial design, a product designer, and back then, really, what I wanted to do was design cars. And, you know, they were talking this morning about what haven't you done. Well, I haven't designed a car yet. So maybe that's still in my future. I started out with two high-tech companies in Boston right out of college, Wang Laboratories and Digital Equipment. Anyone remember those two companies?
Mm, yeah. Yes.
So both of them were innovators, you know, Wang Laboratories and Digital Equipment. And both were acquired and had different histories, and they no longer exist. My entry into design was really product design when computers were making their way from the big computer rooms onto the desktop. And I was the first woman at Wang to be awarded a patent, a design patent. And I don't say that as much around that award as much as it was 30 years ago. And it still amazes me how much there still is to do for women and in design and in product. So I'm always amazed at, you know, the value that women bring to design, and always encourage women who are creative to go into the field of design. I moved to Munich, Germany, and had my own design consultancy with my husband, and then set off on a journey that turned out to be my most creative and most energizing experience was 12 years at Nike in Beaverton, Oregon. And there I was a creative director in a number of roles, but most near and dear to my heart was really leveraging design, design leadership, product, color, materials, print, pattern, all those emotional connections that consumers make. I retired from Nike 3 years ago, and now I'm an independent consultant. But I'm still a designer at heart and like to get my hands on product and helping things come to reality.
That's great. So having both worked at and working for massive brands, what do you think are the most important tools to any kind of brand strategy and marketing strategy?
So I actually think there are a number of really important tools, and I truly believe it all starts with design. You know, it's of course you have to understand what your assets are and what you bring, what your corporation stands for, and what its assets are, frankly. But if you have an ugly design of whatever it is that you have created, it's not going to represent your company well. So we have just spent the last 2 years at Comcast Corporation. So corporation is the entity that is the parent company, and within our children, so to speak, or our divisions are Comcast Cable Company and NBC Universal. We had three things that have been going on in the last 2 years that served to coalesce a look and an evaluation of our corporate brand. One was that our cable company has changed dramatically and evolved over the last 3 to 5 years. We are a technology company, and we provide some of the most essential products and services to Americans across the United States. So we are a technology company. We are not the cable company that we were when we were established 50 years ago. In 3 weeks, we will be, or actually 2 weeks, we will be celebrating our 50th anniversary. And the company has changed dramatically and evolved over those 50 years. And then thirdly, we acquired NBC Universal 3 years ago. And acquiring a media company has very much changed our organization. So it was the perfect time to step back and evaluate who we are as a company and to determine what our brand position was, what our story is, how we want to represent ourselves, and what are all the assets. Everything from being the largest high-speed internet provider in the United States to being the largest video company in the United States to being the third or the fourth largest telephone company in America to being the largest advertising seller of advertising in the world between Comcast and NBC Universal. And then on the other side of the house, NBC, we have NBC Broadcast, we own 21 cable networks, we own Universal Studios that they have actually produced some of the most important and historic films over the past 100 years in America, resorts and parks. And so it was a perfect opportunity to step back and say, who are we and how do we want the world to think about us? And how do we communicate that our company has changed so dramatically? So we started, I am getting to design. So one of the first steps we did was to go through this very rigorous project and process of who we are as a brand, what is our positioning, and then it took us a 9-month design process to come up with what I believe is a beautiful and very elegant brand. And that was important to me because we are now a Fortune 50 company. We rank 47 or 48, it goes back and forth, on the Fortune 500 companies in America. That's an incredible company and an incredible brand. And so we wanted to create something that will have longevity for the next 50 years. We have an incredible future ahead of us, and that when consumers look at it, and when our employees look at it, and the people that we want to recruit to our company, that they say, wow, what an incredible company. And so design was really important to that.
Thank you. You know, I think that when you see the results that you've had, you know, you really understand the tremendous energy and effort that goes into something like that. You know, I think when you're looking at how to make the most and create a brand that's lasting, I think the ones that have worked are the ones that really connect into their consumer. And we all say that, But really, I think there needs to be, I like to say, a consumer obsession, really understanding who you're designing for and who you're speaking with, right? And this obsession, you know, will lead you in the right direction. And I think that's done in a number of ways. I think, you know, at Nike, there is a power of observation, right? And watching what people do and watching how athletes play and perform. And that observation, you know, leads you to have enough information to proceed from your gut and rigor, right? So I think that balance of instinct and rigor, or that gut feeling and data, is really sort of the successes that I've seen from brands. I think the other one, and going back to the consumer-centric, is, you know, tapping into the rhythm of life of who your consumer is, because that's exactly where they will meet you. And it's always, always easy to do that when you watch them. And they will tell you, you know, where they are going. And as you innovate and understand your brand, you know, that's what I like to call that heart and mind, right? It's where the heart and mind of the consumer and the heart and mind of the brand come together. And I think that that understanding of the rhythm of life, whether it's by month, by week, by day, is something that I've always relied on from a design perspective and a brand perspective to deliver, you know, deliver what people want and also what they didn't know they could have.
So to sum that up, when we really talk about creating a long-lasting brand, the first point we'd make is you have to have a compelling story. Mm-hmm. You have to clearly articulate what that story is. You have to really understand your consumer. And you have to create something that they're just crazy about, that they really want and want to consume. So one of the things we're observing right now is a culture that's ever-changing when it comes to what tools should be in the marketing mix. For example, I go into a lot of meetings, and my client might say, print's dead. It's all about experiential. We're done with this. It's now all about social. And I think it'd be really interesting to hear from two massive brands again that I think have to both stay current and also understand how to protect the brand integrity and what matters to the brand and to consumers. How do you deal with this ever-changing marketing landscape that's now really gone into strategy? I mean, it's a big part of brand strategy now, even design, you know, or your marketing communications. Do you communicate something via Twitter? Or do you do something that's what we would call more standard and issue a press release? And how do you work within these ever-changing tools to make sure you have the right mix that works for you?
You know, I just will answer quickly, and then we can hopefully go back and forth a bit. You know, I think you have to innovate, and innovation is also a term that's thrown around a lot, but I think you have to innovate around your core and what you're good at and what's new and exciting, right? I think if you stop innovating around what you're really good at, you know, an example is Louis Vuitton, right? They never stop innovating around their brand equities and their brand strategies. They have to create it, and they can't get bored with it. So I don't think these days, even though things are changing, you can't get bored with what's core to your business. And then you have to keep looking out and innovating and looking for what's new. So I think that balance, again, is really key.
Agree. And we, so at Comcast, we have two major brands that we protect and that we present to the public. One is the one I was talking to you about, the Comcast corporate brand, and then we have the Xfinity brand. The Xfinity brand is our product brand for our cable company, and the Xfinity brand represents all the energy, innovation, all the essential products that we provide to our customers. So how do you decide what mix do you use? And I'm gonna go back to the corporate brand for 1 second, because I saw the most fascinating chart about a month ago in Washington, D.C. We were really trying to understand how our key audiences and influencers consume the media, very broadly defined. And so there was this study done, 24 of the 24-hour news cycle in a key influencer's life in Washington, D.C. And it was a chart that literally, and there was all this research, you know, quantitative as well as focus groups as to what do you do and how do you consume press. And the chart shows that when an individual gets up at 7 o'clock in the morning, the first thing they do, and this is very Washington, D.C. centric, so keep that in mind, all right? The first thing they do, their BlackBerry or their Apple phone or whatever, Samsung is next to their bedstand, they pick that up first thing before coffee. First thing, and they look at this publication, Politico, and it's Mike Allen's, what's going on today in Washington, D.C. So they start with their mobile device, and they look at what's going on. Then they turn on the television, and they turn to either MSNBC, or they turn to CNBC, depending what world they're in, and while they're getting dressed and showered, blah, 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 they watch those two. We happen to own them, so I'm not telling you that because we own them, but that is what they do in the Washington mindset. Then they go from there to looking at the paper quickly. Then they get in the car, and they listen to two radio stations, very specific, and drive time.
Nobody's going for a run or anything.
You know, they have no life. I don't know when they exercise, but... Then they listen to two radio stations during drive time. Then they get into the office, they get on their computers, and they go to a variety of websites to check on what's happening in politics. Then they go back to the newspaper, and they read through three different newspapers. Then from like 11 o'clock until 4 o'clock, they bounce back and forth between their mobile devices and their computer screens and what's going on. Then they have their functions, because that's what everybody does in Washington. They have after work functions. Then they go home, and they some people will go and watch the news on demand. They never get home in time to watch the evening news. Never, never. They watch Comedy Central. We don't own them, so I can tell you that. So advertising on Comedy Central, if you're trying to reach that audience, is very important. They watch the evening, Jay Leno or whomever. I'm in bed, so I don't watch any of that stuff. And then they go to bed, and they start it all over again. And they watch, and we have been watching this cycle of how those key influencers get information, their news and entertainment, and it's fascinating. And then we do that as well with a variety of other audiences, but it just tells you all, print is not dead. Depends where you are and how old you are and what you're looking for. And television broadcasting advertising is not dead either.
No, I think that's interesting. I always say that to my clients. I always say print is not dead. Bad print is, and it should be.
Right.
And I think what you just described is what I hope every good client of mine does, which is really have a profile of their consumer and where they are at every point in the day, because that makes marketing that much easier. Mm-hmm. You know, when we do a lot of our research with the youth market, even in the recession, I always joke that kids were still lining up to get their new Nikes. And when you talk to boys about what matters to them in style, I don't know how many of you know about this trend of 12-year-old boys bidding on eBay for $90 Nike socks.
Oh.
It's the craziest thing I've ever heard of. And it's a pair of socks. And these socks define how cool you are in middle school. And the relevance of eBay and Amazon now to 12-year-old boys is unbelievable to me. But it's because they're bidding on Nike socks. And I thought it was insane. And I kept testing and testing. We've been doing a lot of research around tween boys. And so one of the things I find very interesting is how big brands remain evergreen in a changing world. And it keeps going back to value proposition, mm-hmm. what you're offering consumers, and how you kind of have to just update your offerings. So you look at print magazines, now there's the iPad edition. Look at how Condé Nast completely reinvented that company around an iPad or a tablet device and what you can do interactively. So I think the tools, as we say, the tools are ever-changing, but understanding your consumer and what they do every day is the most important part of marketing. And you've both spoken to that. So I have a fun question. This is the last question also before we want to take your questions. So if you have one, you might want to get close to a mic. So the big question of the day is around social media. Social media has launched superstars. I said jokingly to my team, I felt like I innovated for a year and went and was working, and all of a sudden there are a million new people who are so famous and I've never seen them before in my 17-year career. Mm-hmm. It's literally created superstars. Mm-hmm. And as I work with big corporate clients like Dell, you know, Dell has taken social media as a tool. They have this social media command center. They actually power the Red Cross. And so it's been interesting to watch for-profit and nonprofit work together. And that's one way a company like Dell might use social media. Then you have a situation like Michael Dell is buying back Dell, and that's a very different way that they engage with social media. And so I think for both of you, coming from such huge brands, we know the importance of social. We also know that many big brands are very scared of social, but it's almost a necessary evil, or is it? And so let's talk about how social media plays into the role or into the mix. We've talked about the need to diversify. We've talked about where consumers are every day. But what's the true role that you've seen historically, if we have a historical view of Twitter and social mm-hmm. media and Pinterest and Instagram and all of these and Facebook within your communication strategy and the branding strategy?
You know, I don't have as much experience in social media, but I'm a consumer of it. I'm curious about it, and so I like to keep an eye on it, right? So I think that there's the component of social media that is the marketing component, but I also think that something else has bubbled up that as a designer is super important, and that's the ability to collaborate, right? Intense collaboration. So, you know, you can be working anywhere in the world, and, you know, I think that the age of the rock star designer, the rock star marketer is sort of over, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea of social media has allowed us, you know, to tap into this collective group genius, you know, that's out there. So that's the part of it that, you know, I love and admire and like to look at. You know, I think just on the other hand, that from my perspective in our consulting business, when we talk to brands about it, it's that sense of readiness, right? The social media has given us all a reason to be ready, right? For plan A, plan B, plan C, and I think that's the first question I ask before people want to launch and start to virally get the word out, is that, are you ready? And Darcy, you and I have the conversation, mm-hmm. you know, are you ready for the opportunities and the challenges? Are you ready for the positives and the negatives?
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I actually think about, when I think about social media, I think about it's a tale of two cities. Remember that? We all had to read that in high school. It's a tale of two cities because social media is fantastic. It's a wonderful opportunity to get your brand message out and to position yourselves and to be on top of the conversation from your customers, from your investors, from analysts, from regulators, whoever. But the opposite side of that is it can badly, badly damage your brand very quickly. And the tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that you have invested in your brand can be really seriously impacted if something goes wrong. If you have a problem, and what happens instantly is people tweet and people go to the consumers and they go to, you know, whatever publication now has a blog. And so you absolutely have to be ready. As you said, you have to be ready for the opportunity to take advantage of it so you can get it to your customers. But you always have to, when you're thinking about your communications activities, you always have to think about being on. If you're a large corporation, you need to have surveillance, 24-hour surveillance. You have to have a company who's doing that for you. We have 13 people who work pretty much over an 18-hour period managing customer service online, because if there's an unhappy customer, our digital care team can immediately reach out to that person via Twitter or Facebook or what, you know, whatever it is, whatever they're using, forums, and try and resolve that problem. So social media, I think, is essential, mm-hmm. you know, in any strategy you have anymore. And, you know, having a really beautiful and effective and efficient website mm-hmm. That is representing your brand at a variety of different levels, whether you have a product brand or whether you have a company brand like you do, you cannot get a job pretty much anymore if you don't have a really sophisticated and impressive website that people go to apply for jobs. It's just the way it is anymore. So social, very broadly defined, has become an essential element of a company's life, and it can be very, very scary. And if you're heavily regulated, if you're in the financial community, you know, the lawyers don't want you to do anything, but you have to figure out.
Yeah.
Have to figure out how to use social media to your advantage.
And the book is still being written, right? It's sort of like we're in the middle of it while history is being written about it.
Yeah, it's
great.
It's a tale of two cities.
So we're going to open it
risk
up
and opportunity.
To your questions. So if you have a question, please approach the mic.
Hi, good morning. My question is about elevating a brand. I have, I'm in a luxury business. I'm an interior designer. I own a design firm. And I have a particular clientele, and it's wonderful, and I love it, and I celebrate the diversity of my brand. It's very specific, the diversity of my customer, but pretty specific. And I'd like to elevate that brand to a more affluent consumer. What I've found myself doing is going to my affluent friends and family members and clients and sitting with them and having conversations, but I still see that the profile might be limited. And each of the three of you talked about knowing the profile of your consumer. How do you get a broader profile of a consumer as you're elevating a brand?
Well, I think as a designer and an interior designer, right, you have the power to show people what you're capable of doing. So, you know, if I would look at it from my perspective, I would start to present my brand as that and show the work at that level. Because I think that really, as we become more risk averse, people want to see things, right? They want a safety net to know what you're doing. So, you know, as a designer, I would say show. You know, we used to have to say show more than tell, right? We have that ability to show more than tell about it. Get a one project that, you know, will allow you to show what you're capable of doing and leverage your skills. Leverage those mad skills that you have that nobody else has.
That's actually when we were going through the redesign of our corporate brand. The group that we worked with kept telling us show not tell, show don't tell, and that you have to show what you're doing on your website. And we use video, a huge amount of video, and incredible colors, and effective digital processes. But show not tell. And if you're a designer, showing is what you do. That follow that principle.
Yeah, and right. You know, I just, as much as we, I think we can tell great stories and we like to write great stories, I just don't think people are stopping long enough to read things that are longer than 140 characters.
Right.
You know,
that's true.
Could you take the umbrella principles that you gave and bring them down more specifically for those of us who are solopreneurs, or I have a small consulting firm with a niche market? So in terms of branding going forward, what principles or what specifics or what stories would you recommend?
So I think that the basic principles is you have to determine, and it doesn't really matter what size company you are, really, you have to decide what you stand for and what your brand is going to stand for and what you do. And that process, I will say the process of either evaluating your brand or creating your brand can be very difficult. It takes a lot of time, a lot of thinking, a lot of emotional and intellectual capacity to really say, who am I? Or if you're an individual practitioner and you're trying to create your brand, who am I? What do I stand for? What are the things that I can deliver to a customer? What are the proof points behind that that allow me with credibility to say, this is what my brand is. This is what my company's brand is. This is how I can deliver, and this is what I've been doing. And you should collect your stories. That stories also are a proof point. Mm-hmm. So whether you are doing something with design, creating a website or a brochure or logo, whatever it is, you can't do that without first doing that hard, hard work of what does my brand stand for? And what problem am I addressing through my work? Or what product am I delivering? And does it withstand the truth factor? You can't create a brand that's not true and really isn't reflective of what you do. So I actually think the process of really hard thinking and really analyzing what your strengths are and your opportunities is where you begin. Doesn't matter what size you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say to play off of that, I think the most important thing you can do is start to edit as well, right?
Yeah.
Once you understand, you know, what you can do. And I think what Darcy was talking about is something I would call the soul of your brand, that unique soul, that unique story of what you can tell. You know, the CEO of Nike, Mark Parker, used to say we need to edit to amplify, mm-hmm. right? We have to do more with less. You know, our opportunities are limitless, our resources are not. So I would just say I think the role of editor today, and, you know, people ask, what does a creative director do? I say a creative director is probably more of an editor than they are a creator. So I think the challenge is to edit, too, once you have the story.
Thank you.
Edit to amplify, that's fantastic.
Like yeah, well, I didn't think of it.
I have to remember that.
I didn't think of that one.
Hi.
Oh, we did.
My question's in the similar vein of hers. I'm a physical therapist. I provide like concierge care where I go to my clients and provide orthopedic and sports care. It's non-traditional, but in a very traditional market. So do you have any suggestions for a small business owner, sole proprietor, who wants to market in a really oversaturated market and more of a service as opposed to a product?
Well, I know, you know, we are in an experience economy, right? And so what is the experience that you offer? What will be different? What is that personal connection that you're going to make? I think people are more open to those types of businesses now than mm-hmm. ever, right? So it's that, what makes that experience unique, even if it's in an oversaturated market? You know, I think Starbucks, you know, found a different way to sell a cup of coffee, something that we're all used to. When you elevate it to that experience, it moves you to a unique position.
Right, and I suspect in your world, word of mouth is going to be really, really important, and I suspect is how you're going to build your practice. And so creating that word of mouth and creating experiences that allow people to experience what you can do, and you may, you know, need to think more broadly. It's you know, it's not just social, it's people saying good things about you. So, you know, can you do small events and that allow you to showcase what you do? And, you know, do you literally every day you get up and you say, there are 3 to 5 things I'm going to do today to make sure people understand who I am and what my brand is. And I tell this to people who are looking for jobs. Like, you have to be so disciplined and so focused. And we have so many things to do. And, you know, I said this to my children when they were looking for a job. I was like, every day, 3 to 5 things. And no matter what you're doing, whether it's sending an email, picking up the phone, having coffee, having breakfast, going to an event, I don't care. But before you put your head down on the pillow, need to be able to check off, I've done those 5 things. And before you know it, you know, you've got momentum built. And it's perhaps the same thing, you know, as you're trying to build your business.
And reminding yourself of what the passion was that drove you to do what you're doing. You know, sometimes we have to remind ourselves what that initial passion was that drove us.
I think that's great. I love that idea of an experience economy. And I think if we think about the brands that resonate the most with us right now. They're really brands that provide a great experience. Mm-hmm. You know, whether there's the experience of bringing into your home now, you know, an entertainment experience that probably only happened at a stadium or at a movie theater that now you can have at your home, or how you feel when you're putting on a pair of Nike running shoes and what it makes you feel you can do. You know, I think we talked about the emotional connection and this experience economy. I think across industries, that's really a great way to interact with your consumer.
Big Good morning.
And small too, right? Yeah. I mean, it's for big corporations or small entrepreneur groups. Yeah.
Good morning. My question is actually along the lines of a smaller company as well. You mentioned the difference between a company brand and a product brand. For a company that is starting out, do you feel it's more important to build your product brand first or your company brand first? And if you need to build them both at the same time, do you have any tips for doing that?
Wow. That's a really hard question.
I have an opinion for sure.
That is a really, really, really hard question. Why don't you give your opinion first so I can think about it?
Yeah, and I'm thinking out loud too, which is really dangerous in a room with a lot of people. For, you know, being in the design and product centric, I think ultimately people are going to you for your product. So I think product is tops, right? And I think you have to work your brand parallel. But when they go in and do the taste test and they don't like the product, they're going to walk away no matter how wonderful the brand is presented. So I think maybe the product, that's my vote.
I think I would go with product first, because that's the experience piece of it that you were just talking about. Your customer is going to experience your product, so it better be darn good.
Yeah.
So I think I'd vote for product. And then, you know, like really create a product brand. You can always tie it to whatever your company name is somehow, but go for the product.
Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
It's a great question.
Hi. Darcy, you mentioned the Comcast-NBC integration, so I was curious of what would be the strategy or strategies when thinking about your brand in terms of a major merger or acquisition?
Well, so that was really a challenge, because we have built the Comcast company by acquiring other companies, but we always acquired other cable companies. And so we would acquire them and integrate them, and they just became Comcast. And in fact, our biggest company that we bought was AT&T Broadband, which was twice our size. And the AT&T brand, you know, that's a pretty big brand. You know, they just became a part of our company. When we bought NBC Universal, that presented a much bigger challenge. And initially, we made a decision that we were not going to change our name, create all different graphics. We were not going to do that. That was not the first agenda item, because we wanted to integrate the company, get it up and running first, and respect for their culture. And we were very clear it was a different company than a distribution company. But after a year, we decided it really was time. And we also found that many, many people didn't know we had bought NBC Universal. Many, many, many people, consumers, did not understand that something had changed. Something had happened. So as we were designing what our logo looked like, one of our driving principles was that whatever we came out with, we wanted people to go, oh, something's changed. Why is the peacock on that brand? You know, if they got that far. And by even asking that question, that would force them to know that something had changed. And we went through an entire process. Should we change our name? Should we change Comcast's name? We must have gone through, 400 possibilities there. Should we do something more than just use the peacock? And then, of course, we have to get those at NBC Universal to feel comfortable with the fact that we were going to be using, one of the world's most iconic brands. A guiding principle was something has changed at Comcast. And when you go to our website, the corporate website, you will so clearly see an entirely different technology experience, as well as the media piece of it. So we wanted to do something that was not just about NBC, but that when you went to our corporate website, which is what everybody, pretty much everybody in America does, they Google something, it takes you somewhere. We wanted them to go to our website and go, oh my God, their navigation experience is incredible. Wow, their video is across all these different devices. They provide the highest high speed in the nation. You know, we want to gently force people to think about us differently, and that's what we did.
Hello. My question is about creating a brand-led, brand-centric organizational culture. And I think that, you know, that has to be based in a more sophisticated understanding of brand, not only as the sort of design tactics, but also as an experience and a set of choices that a company makes. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about some techniques you've used to evangelize for the importance of brand in an organization, because as you well know, I'm sure, the choice that looks good on the marketing plan maybe next month, or even what looks good on the bottom line next week, might not necessarily be the thing that supports the brand long term and strengthens the brand long term. And there are some trade-offs that are sometimes necessary there. So how do you make brand an integral part of corporate decision-making and business strategy?
Okay, and just one housekeeping issue right before we answer. We're going to take just this one last question, and then we're going to have a final thought. So answer this question, then that.
So for me, I think, you know, brand is an essence, right? There's a DNA to a brand, and I think that when a company understands that DNA and starts to share that this is the DNA that we will represent, right? Everything will be the filter through what we put the brand through. You know, you look at it more as a living being than a brand, you know? I think having principles, an ethos around what you believe in, how you innovate, how you create, how you speak to the outside world. I think even if you're a small brand, I think Darcy mentioned that too, taking the time to say who you are and what you stand for, right? Knowing that, because people will then start to understand internally who you are. You know, being as collaborative around that brand, in the creation of that brand identity or that brand DNA is super, super important as well. I think the other is just knowing, you have to know what you're capable of doing today and where you want to go tomorrow as well. So sometimes there's that path, right, the journey. And so understanding what you're capable of delivering and where you want to go and have that timing in mind, you know, that it's not always immediate. I think a brand is really a set core of beliefs, right?
Yeah.
That you believe in, that your consumer believes you can deliver, and then you want to be loud and proud about that. You know, I think that's the way I would say to go about building a brand-centered culture is look at it as the DNA of the company.
I actually believe that as well. I believe your brand is the experience that your customer has. And I think it's incredibly important. And I think it's much easier to say than to do.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's just the reality. Yeah. And so therefore, as brand practitioners, I think you all, you know, have to be really grounded in reality. You can't just be like, oh my God, my brand, nobody do anything bad that could... Yes, of course, you don't want any kind of bad experience, but you also have to understand that there are so many things that go into the million businesses decisions every day, and that's extraordinarily frustrating. Extraordinarily frustrating, because if a brand could just be pure, I mean truly pure, and your experience with your brand is, you know, the cup of coffee or the television experience or...
Lovely,
You know, your shoes, whatever the heck it is, your brand is sacred. It's like really, it's the heart and soul of what you are, but lots of bad stuff happens, you know?
And you can't fall in love too deep, right? Because if something or someone is is encouraging you to shift, then you have to be nimble. Again,
right.
It's a living
right.
being. It's not a thing.
Yeah.
That's great. So one last question, and I'm going to answer this too. Is there a brand outside of the ones that you work with that you're completely in love with right now?
Yes. It's a brand I have loved for decades. Because I think it's always on brand, and it's a French brand. And I have some friends in the audience who know what I'm going to say, but it's a brand called Hermès. They make...
This is Hermès.
No.
Is it? So, ladies, gentlemen, for those gentlemen who are here, they make fabulous ties, too. But it is timeless, and they're... Their current website is so really cool, and it's a 100-year-old company, so that's the brand I love.
I agree.
Yeah, so the brand that I've been in love with since I first heard about it is Porsche.
Well, that's not so bad either.
I mean, from a design perspective, just from a company perspective, I think Porsche is just one of those brands that they keep surprising you, they keep exciting you, and they keep delivering on what they're unbelievably good at, and that
mm-hmm.
is building great, great cars that are fun to drive and look amazing. So Porsche and Hermes. That's
God, wouldn't we look
right.
good in a Porsche?
Yeah.
And
with a little
Hermes. With a little scarf?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so mine, mine is a brand called Warby Parker. Warby Parker started by four guys from Wharton Business School, who wanted to innovate glasses and make them affordable. And so they've taken a $400 pair of glasses and turned it into a $95 experience, completely web-based. For every pair you buy, they donate a pair Vision to a child in the developing world through an organization called Vision Spring. And if you Google Warby Parker, you will see that New Yorker or New York Times has a love affair with this brand. And they are about a $350 million company with about 300 employees in New York. And it's a very cool upstart brand. It's kind of one of the big, I guess you would say, success stories of the last few years. And it's all around the social good. And so making very sexy products that do good is something that's probably new and interesting. And I think they have a really interesting future, especially with Mickey Wexler, who is the
mm-hmm.
founder of J.Crew, is on their board. Just got some capital from American Express. So very cool company that's kind of building up right now. And great name and very good product. So that would be my brand.
That's cool.
So thank you all so much
thank
for
you.
Your time.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.